as it takes to hear these arguments, let's go now to NPR News. It's 10 o'clock.
This is live special coverage from NPR News. I'm Susan Davis. In a moment, the Supreme Court will begin oral arguments that could impact the fate of birthright citizenship. That right is defined in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, which grants citizenship to almost everyone born on U.S. soil. President Trump signed an executive order ending birthright citizenship on his first day in office back in January. But this case is about more than just birthright citizenship. The court is expected to consider the use of nationwide injunctions issued by lower courts that block such executive orders, including this one, from taking place. While we wait for the oral arguments to begin, I want to bring in my colleagues, NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson and NPR Immigration Reporter Jimena Bustillo. Hello to you both.
Hi there.
And we're also lucky to have in studio Amanda Frost. She's a law professor at the University of Virginia School of Law. And much to our luck today, she has written extensively about both birthright citizenship and nationwide injunctions. Amanda, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I want to start, Jimena, with a little bit of Constitution 101. Can you talk more explicitly about what the Constitution says about birthright citizenship and then what Trump tried to do with his executive order?
Mm-hmm. So the concept of birthright citizenship is when you are automatically a citizen of a country, in this case, the United States, simply by being born within the bounds of its territory. And it is, as you mentioned in your intro, afforded by the 14th Amendment, which says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. This came about after the Civil War, which afforded recently emancipated African Americans citizenship. And, you know, since has generally been interpreted to mean if you are born here, you are a citizen of this country. Congress also codified birthright citizenship in around 1940. Now, Trump promised throughout his campaign that he was going to take efforts to reinterpret this, repeal, change that idea, that concept of birthright citizenship, you know, arguing that it is not something that benefits the United States, that he would do it. And on day one, he did fulfill that promise by issuing an executive action that reinterpreted the meaning of the 14th Amendment. So his interpretation really focuses on the phrasing subject to the jurisdiction thereof to say that those who have one parent who is a citizen or lawful permanent resident, you know, that can help afford you birthright citizenship, but it gets really complicated. He says that it would not apply if, for example, both parents are unauthorized, and gets even more complicated, you know, really breaking down the status of mothers and fathers and if they're here on temporary basis or not, which would really affect a large group of people, thinking about folks who might be in the country with authorization, like refugees or asylees, but are not lawful permanent residents and are not citizens, and, you know, what might happen if they were to have children.
Carrie, to no surprise, this executive order was almost immediately challenged in the courts. Where was it challenged, and what did those lower courts decide?
I think the first state who challenged it was Washington State, within 24 hours of Trump signing the order on his first day in office. And then what the Supreme Court is about to hear this morning is a consolidation of three separate cases involving 22 states, as well as immigrant rights groups and a small number of expecting parents as well. So what happened in the lower courts is that district court judges basically blocked the order, and those judges found agreement with appeals courts. So every judge who has considered this issue has blocked it for now. The Supreme Court seems to have taken this case at a very early posture, and it's very unusual for the court to take something like this and order oral argument off the emergency docket. In fact, so unusual that it had been something like 50 years until the court did it during the COVID period in the U.S. And so it's an important moment, and I think it's meaningful. It's maybe one of the most important cases the court will hear this
and
year.
Because everything is political, I do think it's worth noting that both conservative and liberal appointed justices upheld this nationwide injunction.
That's exactly right. Every judge or lower court judge who has heard this case has sided with the challengers to this executive order. In fact, the idea of birthright citizenship is pretty foundational. It goes back to the post-Civil War 1994 period. Then in an 1898 case, the Supreme Court basically affirmed it in the case of a baby boy born in San Francisco to Chinese parents. And the Congress basically codified it in the Nationality Act over 60 years ago. So, you know, President Trump has been quite vocal about not liking and not supporting birthright citizenship, but within the vast majority of the legal scholarship, it's settled law. And to argue otherwise has been a fringe legal theory until relatively recently.
Professor Frost, can you explain exactly what the question is before the court today? Because it's my understanding that it doesn't explicitly get at the notion of birthright citizenship.
Yes. So the court may touch on the constitutionality of the executive order in light of the 14th Amendment's guarantee of birthright citizenship, but that will not be the focus today. The focus instead is on the scope of the injunctive relief. So the lower courts, three of them, issued what are called nationwide or universal injunctions, which prohibited the Trump administration from applying the executive order not only to the individual expectant pregnant women before the court as parties, but to anyone in the United States, and said you can't apply this executive order going forward to anyone. That's known as a universal or nationwide injunction. This court has been concerned about their use or overuse in the past, and that's the question it's exploring in its oral argument today.
Can you talk more about this issue of nationwide injunctions? Because I think of it sometimes, again, politically, where it's always a problem when the other party's doing it. This is something that both Republican and Democratic presidents have been have had nationwide injunctions block them from enacting executive orders.
Yeah, and there's lots of hypocrisy around this issue, certainly in Congress, when people are upset when their own party's president's policies are enjoined, but they like it when it happens the other way. So yes, this is something that's been of more and more concern to the justices. Universal injunctions have existed for a long time, many decades, but it is true that they are far more frequent today than in the past. It's also true that there are far more executive orders issued by presidents that unilaterally change the law today than in the past. Obama saw some of his sweeping attempts to change immigration law enjoined nationwide. Biden's student loan forgiveness program was enjoined nationwide. And President Trump, who's issued a record number of executive orders, has seen a record number of injunctions, nationwide injunctions.
I mean, President Trump also, I think it's been a clear directive of his presidency that part of what he's doing is trying to expand the boundaries of presidential power. And it's hard not to see this executive order within that scope of getting to rewrite the Constitution.
Yeah, the hallmark of the Trump presidency is the power to unilaterally change law. He's done it across many different areas, not just immigration, although immigration particularly. And I would say this birthright citizenship executive order purporting to end a constitutional right that has been protected and long recognized for over a century by every branch of government is epitomizes that approach to law. And that's the context in which the court will analyze nationwide injunctions today.
Jimena, NPR also has new polling out today that gets at some of the public sentiment around this issue. What is the poll say? Mm-hmm.
A new NPR Ipsos poll finds that less than a third of all Americans agree with the idea of dropping birthright citizenship as we have just talked about it, as it's understood today. It's one of Trump's least popular of his immigration policies broadly, though, you know, when you kind of break down this polling along party lines, you'll see more Republicans support it than Democrats. Democrats are more likely to oppose it, which is true across the board with a lot of his policy proposals.
Well, and does it tell us any more about the broader views about immigration beyond birthright citizenship? Because one thing that is notable to me is that, look, immigration is an issue that Donald Trump won this election on. I don't think that that's a disputed point. But since he has been enacting a lot of these immigration actions, his approval rating has steadily declined, which suggests that maybe the execution of how he's doing these policies isn't exactly in line with public sentiment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the poll describes the overall sentiments as like lukewarm. You know, like there's no policy that seems to receive significant majority support. And especially when you break it down into questions of due process or questions about the economy or questions about people's neighbors or families or communities specifically being affected, that's where you kind of start to see a little bit of dissonance between people's broad opinions of a national policy versus how it might affect their community.
Carrie, what can you tell us about who will be arguing on behalf of the administration today?
Arguing for the administration is the new Solicitor General, John Sauer. He may be familiar to people because as Trump's private lawyer, he argued that major immunity case before the Supreme Court last term. Same guy. He also was a clerk for Justice Scalia back in the day and has served in major legal roles in Missouri. And arguing for the other parties are Jeremy Feigenbaum. He's the Solicitor General of the state of New Jersey, which is one of the states, 22 states challenging this executive order. And arguing for the immigrant rights groups and the expectant parents is Kelsey Corcoran. She's a former Supreme Court clerk herself to Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She now works at the Institute for Constitutional Advocacy and Protection at Georgetown. She's a former DOJ lawyer as well.
We hopefully will be getting to oral arguments soon. But Carrie, I imagine this is a case where we might have some layman listeners who aren't attuned to how these proceedings normally go. Broadly speaking, what do we expect to hear today and the run of show of this?
Sure. So the Solicitor General, John Sauer, will get the first word. And then fairly soon thereafter, the justices may jump in and start asking questions. And since the COVID period, it's been the practice of the court to go one by one, starting by seniority, starting with Justice Clarence Thomas and ending with the newest Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asking questions. Then the side of the people arguing against the executive order, Solicitor General for New Jersey will get 15 minutes and Kelsey Corcoran at Georgetown will get another 15 minutes. But Sue, I got to tell you, even though the court has allotted 1 hour for this argument, it could go much longer than that, more than double, depending on how animated the justices are and how many questions they have for each other and for the people arguing.
Yes, I guess justices can speak as long as they like. That's one of the perks of the office. Yeah. Professor, I also think it's important and illuminates maybe the interest from the court in this case in the fact that they did decide to hear oral arguments, which isn't always the case. Can you illuminate sort of that process?
Yeah, so as I think we've already heard, that was extraordinarily rare for this court to grant oral argument in a case from its emergency docket. So this isn't one of those cases that's heard on the merits where there's a petition for writ of certiorari and the court gets full briefing and schedules it for argument. That's the typical normal process for a case that comes to it through that process of granting cert. This is a case from the emergency docket. It's very rare to grant the oral argument. The fact that it did so suggests it is very serious about the idea of limiting or cabining or changing the standards for granting universal or nationwide injunctions. And so I'm assuming that will be the focus today. Of course, the court might also touch on the constitutionality of the executive order. There's nothing to stop it from doing that. But very likely its focus today is on this question of the nationwide injunction and the scope of that of power of lower courts to issue those kinds of injunctions.
Are there any justices in particular that you are curious to hear from or what their line of questioning is? Who are the unknown justices in this case?
Yeah, I think the justices that I am definitely going to be paying closest attention to are Justice Barrett and Justice Kavanaugh. Mm. They suggested in a concurrence last term that they are concerned about universal injunctions. But they also recognize the costs of imposing them and the benefits of imposing them. They are not going to have a bright line on-off rule. They're going to want some sort of limiting principle that allows lower courts to issue nationwide injunctions, but does so within limits. That's my guess, of course, just my supposition. And so I think their questions for the advocates are going to be about trying to get that limiting principle. And they may even float a limiting principle themselves, hoping to attract some of the other justices.
Carrie, I think that this also has the potential to be a bigger case because there are many executive orders under this president also facing nationwide injunctions. So the implications of this case could be rather significant.
They could. And let's just point out, this is the first big case from President Trump's second term that this court has heard oral argument on. But it certainly will not be the last. Many of Trump's actions have been challenged, more than 200 lawsuits already this year so far. And depending on how the courts approach this issue of universal injunctions, it could have implications for lawsuits involving the mass firings of federal workers, diversity, equity, and inclusion policies, and others as well.
Carrie, I'm going to interrupt you. We're going to go to the Supreme Court where oral arguments are beginning.
Cases. General Sauer.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. On January 20th, 2025, President Trump issued Executive Order 14160, protecting the meaning and value of American citizenship. This order reflects the original meaning of the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed citizenship to the children of former slaves, not to illegal aliens or temporary visitors. Multiple district courts promptly issued nationwide or universal injunctions blocking this order, and a cascade of such universal injunctions followed. Since January 20th, district courts have now issued 40 universal injunctions against the federal government, including 35 from the same five judicial districts. This is a bipartisan problem that has now spanned the last five presidential administrations. Universal injunctions exceed the judicial power granted in Article 3, which exists only to address the injury to the complaining party. They transgress the traditional bounds of equitable authority, and they create a host of practical problems. Such injunctions prevent the percolation of novel and difficult legal questions. They encourage rampant forum shopping. They require judges to make rushed, high-stakes, low-information decisions. They circumvent Rule 23 by offering all the benefits but none of the burdens of class certification. They operate asymmetrically, forcing the government to win everywhere while the plaintiffs can win anywhere. They invert the ordinary hierarchy of appellate review. They create the ongoing risk of conflicting judgments. They increase the pressures on this court's emergency docket. They create what Justice Powell described as repeated and essentially head-on confrontations between the life-tenured and representative branches of government. And they disrupt the Constitution's careful balancing of the separation of powers. I welcome the court's questions.
General Sauer, these universal injunctions, as you say, have proliferated over the last three decades or so. Would you discuss, though, the origins of universal injunctions? In particular, I'm interested in sort of historical analogs or the historical pedigree, particularly the Bill of Peace that was proffered by respondents.
Yes, Justice Thomas, as you, I think, first pointed out in your separate opinion in Trump against Hawaii, the Bill of Peace is something very distinct from a universal injunction. So the Bill of Peace involved a resolution of a small, discrete set of claims of a small, discrete group. And even more fundamentally, it was binding on the members of that class and those represented by the class. So it's much more analogous to a modern class action under Rule 23. And in fact, as we've argued in other cases, and as this court has described in opinions like Ortiz, the Bill of Peace evolved into and is directly developed into, so to speak, the modern class action that has all the same features of a Bill of Peace. So in the words of Chief Judge Sutton in the Sixth Circuit, the Bill of Peace, it was a domesticated animal that looks nothing like the dragon of a universal injunction.
I'm sorry. Here, there's a discrete identified group on one issue. Does citizenship mean are you born in the territory of the United States, or does it mean are you loyal to someone else, which is your claim, or are your parents loyal to someone else? So that's no different than what happened in a peace, in a Bill of Peace. The United States is bigger, so it extends more broadly, but it's still an identifiable group on a discrete, singular question.
Your Honor, I'd say three things in response to that. First of all, our primary contention is that the citizenship clause related to the children of former slaves, not to illegal aliens who weren't even present as a discrete class at that time. But more fundamentally here, as to the issue of the Bill of Peace, there are critical differences. The Bill of Peace was a binding judgment that would bind absent class members. Here we have the ACE.
Well, here class actions don't bind anyone who opts out, so class actions are not like bills of peace.
I would think that a Rule 23b2 class action, which would be the relevant analog here, would be one that would be binding on absent class members and would not have the same notice and opt-out procedures. And more fundamentally, that sort of argument that there's a commonality here among, you know, all the people who purport to be affected by this is the sort of argument that's made in class certification.
So can I ask you a question? Your theory here is arguing that Article 3 and principles of equity both prohibit federal courts from issuing universal injunctions. Do I have your argument correct?
We argue both of those.
You argue both of those?
Yeah.
If that's true, that means even the Supreme Court doesn't have that power.
The Supreme Court would have the authority to issue binding precedent nationwide. But, as
but
this
we
court,
couldn't enforce it against universally, is your argument.
If there was a decision that violated the precedent of the court, then the affected plaintiffs could get a separate judgment.
And that means you're talking about the hundreds and thousands of people who weren't part of the judgment of the court. They would all have to file individual actions?
This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
Or a class action?
A class action would be
the way that makes no sense whatsoever.
Respectfully, we believe
that what was the purpose of the Bill of Peace if not to settle a legal question finally? And if even the Supreme Court doesn't have that right and must invite hundreds of thousands of lawsuits, what are we buying into?
If a set of claims satisfies the rigorous criteria of Rule 23, Rule 23 is the modern analog of a Bill of Peace. We have something very different here.
No, we don't, because the argument here is that the president is violating an established, not just one, but by my count, four established Supreme Court precedents. We have the one ARC case where we said fealty to a foreign sovereign doesn't defeat your entitlement, your parents' fealty to a foreign sovereign, doesn't defeat your entitlement to citizenship as a child. We have another case where we said that even if your parents are here illegally, if you're born here, you're a citizen. We have yet another case that says even if your parents came here and were stopped at the border, but you were born in our territory, you're still a citizen. And we have another case that says even if your parents secured citizenship illegally, you're still a citizen. So as far as I see it, this order violates four Supreme Court precedents.
And you are
claiming that not just the Supreme Court, that both the Supreme Court and no lower court can stop an executive from universally from violating that holding, those holdings by this court.
We are not claiming that because we're conceding that there could be an inappropriate case.
Only a class. Only
can I hear the rest of his answer?
A Rule 23 class action. And then the more fundamental point as to all those Supreme Court decisions you referred to.
So what do we do temporarily?
Temporarily, the court may issue, the lower courts may issue injunctions that remediate the injuries to the plaintiffs that appear before them. Lower courts in appropriate cases may certify
so when a new president so when a new president orders that because there's so much gun violence going on in the country and he comes in and he says I have the right to take away the guns from everyone, then people and he sends out the military to seize everyone's guns, we and the courts have to sit back and wait until every named plaintiff gets, or every plaintiff whose gun is taken comes into court.
In appropriate cases, courts have certified class actions on an emergency basis. We found at least four cases in recent years where that was done. But more fundamentally, we profoundly disagree with the characterization of the merits. This is now fully briefed in the Ninth Circuit in case number 25-807, where we describe how that characterization of the holding of Wong Kim Ark and the other decisions is profoundly incorrect. And
you still have
counsel. Could I ask you about a different type of case that has broader impact than on the particular claimant? Like a claimant who's alleging that the districting in a particular case has resulted in racial discrimination against him or her based on how the district is drawn. Now, a judicial decision about that one plaintiff would implicate the redistricting throughout the whole case. So throughout the whole state. How does your theory address that situation?
That would be what you might call an indivisible remedy, where what the court is doing there by, for example, redrawing the district lines is, as this court said in Gill against Whitford, the only way to remediate the injury of voting in an unconstitutionally drawn district. That is similar to abatement of a public nuisance or, for example, in the school desegregation cases, where remediating the injury to the plaintiff before the court necessarily has collateral consequences to many others. And certain environmental cases might have a similar thing. For example, you stop the local plant from pouring, you know, water pollution into the water. That benefits the plaintiff. It happens to benefit a bunch of other people. Now, that's very different than what we have in these universal injunctions, where it is a divisible remedy. I mean, I point to the holding of the District of Massachusetts in this case, looking at the individual plaintiffs. That court said, well, obviously, I don't have to give a universal injunction to protect individuals other than the individual plaintiffs. They are given complete relief by an injunction that tells federal officials only to treat their children as
citizens.
But why,
I guess the question is, why does the law require that? I mean, I appreciate that a court could, in a divisible remedy kind of case, narrow in to the plaintiff, but you seem to be suggesting that Article 3 or Rule 23 or something requires that. And I guess I don't really understand it.
If I may,
that was Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson.
In the Article 3 context, that is the principle announced in Worth against Selden, announced in Gill against Whitford, and Lewis against Casey, where this court has said again and again, what we do in the Article 3 context is grant remedy that is tailored to grant remedies that are tailored to remove the injury to the complaining plaintiff. Sometimes they have even very broad collateral consequences. But in the Article 3 context, what the court has not done, and every time it's focused on this, in National Treasuries Union, Employees Union, in the
Perkins. But I guess I don't see why then the divisible remedies or indivisible remedies is an argument. I mean, if Article 3 is suggesting that the court has to focus in on the plaintiff only, then it would seem to me that that would be the power requirement across the board. I thought Article 3 was really about limiting the court's power with respect to jurisdiction, that we say the court has to determine whether or not there's subject matter jurisdiction over the issue and whether or not there's personal jurisdiction over the defendant. And once you have those things, the court can evaluate the merits of the legal issue and issue, especially in equity, appropriate relief. Now, I appreciate that there are some prudential concerns that the court considers, but it seems to me that in many, many, many circumstances, we have not required the court to limit their relief to the particular plaintiff as a matter of constitutional Article 3 requirement.
I disagree with that. I'd offer a response both first as to Article 3 and then as to the scope of equitable authority. In the Article 3 context, this court said in Worth against Selden, for example, that the Article 3 judicial power exists only to redress the injury to the complaining parties. Again, in Gill against Whitford and Lewis against Casey.
All right, so let me give you a hypothetical. So suppose we have a manufacturing plant that unlawfully releases environmental toxins into the air, and we have a plaintiff who lives near the plant, brings a nuisance lawsuit and says they're being harmed by unlawful release. Your argument suggests that the judgment for the plaintiff has to narrow in on preventing, to the extent possible, preventing harm to the plaintiff. But it seems to me that that's not necessarily the case. You suggest with the Chief Justice in response to him that there can be incidental beneficiaries, that the court could say no more toxins if it's unlawful for the defendant to do that, correct?
Yes, we do.
So why, if your Article 3 principle is correct?
Because, again, the Article 3 principle is remedying the injury to the plaintiff who, or set of plaintiffs, could be many, who are before the court.
Right.
That has collateral consequences.
Counsel,
that could help.
Let me ask you on that point, would one distinction be who's bound by the judgment? Like, I'm wondering whether if the plaintiff needs, you can only, I think Judge Strauss said in the Eighth Circuit when addressing this issue, you can't peel off part of a nuisance, so the whole thing has to be shut down. Could a neighbor sue affirmatively to hold the nuisance maker in contempt if he started to begin again the nuisance?
This is Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
It would not be bounding on those collaterally benefited
parties, so to speak. I don't want to call them parties because they're not parties before the court. And that, of course, highlights one of the deep problems with the universal injunction.
No, but why could you do that? Answer, though?
Could you do that now for the universal injunction? Could a plaintiff, for example, who has the protection of the universal injunction but was not named in the suit, bring a contempt action of the sort I just described?
They could not do that, but what they could do is run to any of 93 other judicial districts and bring their own lawsuit if they
No.
Under the injunctions as they stand, could a non-named plaintiff who has the benefit of the universal injunction that's currently in place, could that plaintiff bring a contempt proceeding?
We would.
Or I guess I shouldn't call them a plaintiff. Could that non-party?
We would dispute that they would have the standing to do that because it goes to the heart of.
Well, no. Let's see. Maybe I'm not being clear. Assume the universal injunction is good. Like, drop your argument right now.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
As they currently stand, could someone who is not named in the suit but a beneficiary bring a contempt proceeding?
I think that is what the respondents would certainly contend.
Do you concede that the plaintiffs could bring a Rule 23, like the individual plaintiffs?
We would dispute. I mean, we'd have to address the Rule 23 issues, kind of all the criteria as
okay.
they came up.
But they could seek it. Okay, and then last question.
They haven't done that in Western District of Washington. It's just never been briefed because they blocked
the passage. Okay, just last question on this point. The states have a different kind of claim for financial harm, and they've pointed out that it would be very difficult to remedy that without some sort of broader relief. I know you can test their standing. I want you to assume that I think they have standing. Why wouldn't they be entitled to an injunction of the scope of the one that has currently been entered?
I would say two reasons. First of all, it's not necessary to provide complete relief to the plaintiffs. What we offered, for example, in the District of Massachusetts in the Second or the First Circuit was an injunction that would enjoin the federal officials and order them to treat the people who would otherwise be covered by the executive order as eligible for the services that result in the pocketbook injuries to the states. And there's really no response to that. That is obviously would fully remediate their injuries and does not require the injunction to be applied in all other 50 states. One state comes in and says, well, people are going to move across state lines. Therefore, we've got 21 states in this case who don't want this relief. Sorry, you've got to impose it on everybody because it has to be offered to this one particular state. So that's one response. The other response is this notion that the states have to be provided a complete relief because of interstate travel and patchwork. I think that's very effectively responded to by Chief Judge Sutton's opinion in the Second Circuit, where he says this is a problem. If we adopt this logic, it justifies a universal injunction in every single case, and that can't be the case. The Fifth Circuit's recent DACA decision comes to the same conclusion.
What do you say, though, to the suggestion, General, that in this particular case, those patchwork problems for, frankly, the government, as well as for plaintiffs, justify broader relief?
That is Justice Neil Gorsuch.
Again, Chief Judge Sutton addressed that directly as well when he said that's the federal government's problem. In other words, the federal government, for example, in the First Circuit, we offered that as a narrower scope of injunction, and the decision was, well, that would cause you too many administrative problems. And I think Chief Judge Sutton directly addresses that when he says that's a problem for the executive branch.
That's your problem.
Instance.
All right. Yeah. And then with respect to class certification, your friends on the other side point out that takes time. There are, as you've emphasized, hurdles that have to be met to achieve class certification. And the argument, of course, is that the injury is immediate and ongoing. And as Justice Sotomayor suggested, might be seriously questioned as to its compliance with this court's precedents. Your thoughts?
I would offer a couple of things in response to that. First of all, there are tools to achieve sort of class-wide universal relief. I referred earlier that we found four recent district court decisions where class-wide relief was given a kind of an emergency basis. However, more fundamentally than that...
And you agree that that's appropriate in certain cases?
It may be appropriate. We do not concede that it's appropriate in this case, but it may be appropriate in other cases. Certainly, it's an equitable tool that is consistent with, for example, the grant of equitable authority in the 1789 Judiciary Act, as this court interpreted in the Grupo Mexicano decision, and honestly, a line of decisions going all the way back to the early 19th century. So there are tools to address emergency situations, but more fundamentally than that, it is a feature, not a bug, of Article 3 that courts grant relief to the people who sue in front of them. So the notion that relief has to be given to the whole world because others who have not taken the time to sue are not before the courts is something that results in all these problems.
Last question. Do we need to reach the Article 3 question? Wouldn't it be wise, even if you were to prevail, for the court to reserve that question rather than decide that Congress, for example, could never endow this court with that authority?
Although that's exactly correct. The court does not have to rest on Article III because the court could say, and as we've argued, and as Justice Thomas' separate opinion in Trump against Hawaii says, the 1789 Judiciary Act, when it said suits in equity are what the federal courts can do, we had nothing like this in mind. And that I point to the language in Grupo Mexicano where the court said there what was at issue was a preliminary injunction that froze and likely insolvent debtors' assets so that the plaintiff could collect at the end of the case. And the court said that's a nuclear weapon in the law, and were not that had no analog in 1789 in the practices of the Court of Chancery. And if that's a nuclear weapon, I don't know what this is, where it, repeatedly, 40 times in this administration, we're being enjoined against
General,
against the entire world.
I'm just going to ask to you to put yourself in a different frame of mind. Hard to do. Assume something you won't want to assume. But the assumption that I want you to make is that on the merits, which of course you did not take to this court, on the merits, you are wrong, that the EO is unlawful. And I want to ask you, if we assume that, how do we get to that result on your view of the rules?
This is Justice Elena Kagan.
It is very difficult for me to attempt the hypothetical, but I will.
You know, I think that that's the important question in this case. Let's just assume you're dead wrong. How do we get to that result? Does every single person that is affected by this EO have to bring their own suit? Are there alternatives? How long does it take? How do we get to the result that there is a single rule of citizenship that is not, that is the rule that we've historically applied rather than the rule that the EO would have us do?
Rule 23 would be one natural path, assuming that a class could be certified, which we might dispute in this particular case.
Well, you might dispute it. And, you know, I mean, I think the question is, is there a class that's just all children of people who have entered illegally? Is that an appropriate class? Can the same thing be done under Rule 23? Or are you going to tell me that, no, Rule 23 has lots of requirements and you'll never be able to certify a class like that?
Rule 23 provides the equitable tools subject to rigorous criteria, appropriately rigorous criteria, to obtain that kind of class-wide
enumeration. That suggests to me you're going to be standing up here in the next case saying that Rule 23 is inapt for this circumstance with this number of people, maybe with some questions that are individual, who knows. So let's put Rule 23 aside because I got to tell you that does not fill me with great confidence. How else are we going to get to the right result here, which is on my assumption that the EO is illegal?
That would be a profoundly wrong result, but I think what I would offer is that, very similar to Labrador against Poe, what the court should be engaging here is a balancing of the equitable factors as to the scope of remedial relief, not as to the underlying merits. And our contention that this exceeds the traditional scope of equity that's reflected in the 1789 Judiciary Act, we're overwhelmingly likely to succeed on those merits for all the reasons that are stated in our
briefs. Yes, I mean, that's a lot of words, and I don't have an answer for if one thinks. And, look, there are all kinds of abuses of nationwide injunctions. But I think that the question that this case presents is that if one thinks that it's quite clear that the EO is illegal, how does one get to that result in what time frame on your set of rules without the possibility of a nationwide injunction?
On this case and on many similar cases, the appropriate way to do it is for there to be multiple lower courts considering it, the appropriate percolation that flows to the lower courts, and then ultimately this court decides the merits in a nationwide binding precedent. You have a complete inversion of that through the nationwide injunctions with the district courts.
So, General Sauer, are you really going to answer Justice Kagan by saying there's no way to do this expeditiously?
Well, I'll refer to my former answers. Rule 23 provides the tools to do so, multiple injunctions.
But you resisted Justice Kagan when she said, could the individual plaintiffs form a class?
This is Justice Amy Coney Barrett again.
In the court below, I do not concede that we wouldn't oppose class certification in this particular case. There may be arguments that this case is or is not appropriate for class certification.
And if there were a class appropriate for class certification, you concede that that could resolve the question quickly?
Yes, absolutely.
You concede it could resolve the question quickly through precedent?
Yes, absolutely. It could do so. I mean, we obviously dispute the...
So just on that point...
And if the court... Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead, please. All right, I got a quick one.
Well, I'm just going to say on that point. So, you know, let's say there were an individual person even. Let's say it wasn't a class. And goes up and gets a ruling from the Second Circuit that the EO is illegal. Does the government commit to not applying its EO in the entire Second Circuit? Or does it say, no, we can continue to apply the rule as to everybody else in the Second Circuit?
I can't say as to this individual case. Generally, our practice is to respect circuit precedent within the circuit, but there are
exceptions.
Yes, that
is generally your practice, and I'm asking whether it would be your practice in this case.
I can't answer because it would depend on what the lower court decision said. So there are circumstances, as I was suggesting, where we think that we want to continue to litigate that in other district courts in the same circuit as well.
Yeah,
as
so that means it's not even the normal time it takes for everything to get up, you know, through the circuit courts and to the Supreme Court. Because even in those circuits that say that the EO is illegal, you're going to be saying, no, you know, we only commit to saying it's illegal to this one guy who brought the suit.
Article 3 and the court's traditional equitable practices provide a range of tools to address that, including a potentially nationwide class action.
You say you're going to oppose when that gets challenged.
We are likely to oppose
when
on
that
the
gets
merits.
Proposed.
Yes, and if it does not meet the rigorous criteria of class certification, the court should not enter that injunctive relief.
You're not willing to commit to abiding by the Second Circuit's precedent in my... Suppose that there's a single person who brings a suit, and it gets all the way up to us after 3 or 4 or 5 years. And we say, you know, we really do agree with those four precedents that Justice Sotomayor started with, and your EO is illegal. Is that only going to bind the one guy who brought the suit?
No, that would be a nationwide precedent that the government would respect.
So finally, once it gets to us after 4 years, you're going to respect that?
Yes, and in addition, we may well respect circuit-wide precedent. The Second Circuit, it just is...
And for 4 years... there are going to be, like, an untold number of people who, according to all the law that this court has ever made, ought to be citizens who are not being treated as such.
And in the meantime, any of those plaintiffs could have come forward and sought, you know, preliminary injunctive relief. And they could do so on a class-wide basis. There are tools to address this, but the universal injunction, which is issued here 3 days after the executive order was issued, is not one of those tools.
Thank you, counsel. Three years, 4 years, we've been able to move much more expeditiously. I think we did the TikTok case in a month. I gather an important part of your answer is that people can litigate differently, and one will go to Massachusetts, the other one will go to Houston, and you'll get conflicting decisions fairly quickly. Is there any reason why this court, and I gather that's your safety net is that at the end of the day, whatever however long the day is, this court can issue a decision and it will bind everything else. Is there any reason in this particular litigation that we would be unable to act expeditiously?
Absolutely not.
Chief Justice John Roberts.
Okay, thank you. Justice Thomas?
General, when were the first universal injunctions used?
We believe that the best reading of that is what you said in Trump against Hawaii, which is that Wirtz in 1963 was really the first universal injunction. There's a dispute about Perkins against Lucan's Oil going back to 1940. And, of course, we point to the court's opinion that reversed that universal injunction issued by the D.C. Circuit and said it's profoundly wrong. Now, if you look at the cases that the either party cite, you see a common theme. The cases that we cite, like National Treasury's Employment Union, Perkins against Lucan's Oil, Frothingham and Massachusetts against Mellon, going back to Scott against Donald, and all of those are cases where the court considered and addressed the sort of universal, in that case, statewide issue of provision of injunctive relief. So when the court has considered and addressed this, it has consistently said you have to limit the remedy to the plaintiffs who appearing in court and complaining of that remedy.
So we survived until the 1960s without universal injunctions.
That's exactly correct. And in fact, those were very limited, very rare, even in the 1960s. It really exploded in 2007 in our cert petition in Summers Against Earth Island Institute. We pointed out that the Ninth Circuit had started doing this in a whole bunch of cases involving environmental claims.
Justice Alito?
You began by outlining what you see as the practical problems that have been created by universal injunctions. If we were to hold that the states have standing, and if it is possible for a plaintiff to get emergency certification of a class, would we, suppose we agreed with you on universal injunctions, but allowed those other two avenues, would the practical problem be rectified to any substantial degree?
Certainly, if there were an injunction that extended to, you know, all of the litigating states, that would cover a very substantial portion of the country. And also an emergency sort of class certification decision might also grant very broad relief.
So the answer is that the practical problem would not be solved. And if that's the case, what is the point of this argument about universal injunctions?
I think the point is that universal injunctions exceed traditional principles of Article III, and they exceed the traditional equitable authority, and that's what yields all these sort of pathologies, so to speak, of the current practice of issuing them very, very easily.
Thank you.
Justice Sotomayor?
You answered Justice Gorsuch, I think correctly, that if Article III precludes universal injunctions, then even class actions are illegal. That's what you're arguing, isn't it?
I disagree with that profoundly.
How could it? If Article 3 and only prohibits injunctions that affect non-members or non-plaintiffs, how could Congress give a remedy like a class action?
In an article or in a Rule 23 class, every member, represented member of the class, has standing by hypothesis. So every single one of them has an Article 3 injury, and Rule 23, again.
So that would be the only method.
It would be very similar to the Bill of Peace, where all those parties, even their president or representative capacity, are bound.
We can act quickly. If we are worried about those thousands of children who are going to be born without citizenship papers that could render them stateless in some places because some of their parents' homes don't recognize children of their nationals, unless those children are born in their countries, they're not going to be receiving federal benefits, because that's the claim of the plaintiffs here, that they, of the state plaintiffs, that they're not going to be able to provide services to those children. Shouldn't we grant cert before judgment on that issue? If we're afraid that this is, or even have a thought that this is unlawful executive action, that it is Congress who decides citizenship, not the executive. If we believe, some of us were to believe that, why should we permit those countless others to be subject to what we think is an unlawful executive action? As unlawful as an executive taking the guns away from every citizen.
Cert before judgment would be another tool but through which this court could ask expeditiously.
This is the kind of case where the equities would call for that. And why wouldn't it? It's a pure legal question. What does the Constitution mean with respect to citizenship? There are no individual facts that would alter our conclusion. If we can't do it by a universal injunction, because you say Article 3 doesn't permit that, Article 3 wouldn't permit us to give a universal injunction, even if we rule, why don't we grant cert before judgment? So that all of these parents would have a firm Supreme Court decision that they can take where? Because you're saying nobody can grant a universal injunction.
No party has asked for that in this case. And I think one reason is that would deny the court of the benefit of percolation in multiple lower courts of a novel and
right
sensitive
now,
and important constitutional
courts.
Question.
We have novel courts who've percolated this issue and said, you're violating precedent. not only precedent, but the plain meaning of the 14th of the Constitution.
Respectfully, I think what we have are lower courts making snap judgments on the merits that ignore the fundamental principle of the 14th Amendment, that it was about giving citizenship to the children of slaves, not to the children of illegal immigrants who really were not even a very discreet class at that time.
And there were some people in Congress who argued against the 13th Amendment just because of that. Some people who argued against passing the amendment just because of that, because it would give citizenship to gypsies.
I think the relevant history of the 14th Amendment is the statements of Senator Trumbull, who emphasized that domicile was the key criteria, and he said that in a letter to Andrew Jackson. And we've cited our Ninth Circuit briefing, and it got rejected repeatedly.
We can go into the history of citizenship, but I still go back to my question. You claim that there is absolutely no constitutional way to stop a president from an unconstitutional act, a clearly, indisputably unconstitutional act, taking every gun from every citizen. We couldn't stop that.
I disagree with that for the reasons I've said, including the equitable tools.
No, because you said to us we'd have to wait until there was a final judgment. You're not sure you would respect the judgment of every circuit. You're not sure that you would respect even a final judgment of the Supreme Court, because it only binds the parties before it. And if there's no class action, that only binds the parties before the court.
I don't think there is a, so to speak, really, really unconstitutional exception to the strictures of Article III or the scope of equitable authority, and the court should not recognize one, because what we see, not just in this case, but in the 39 others, is that the district courts who are issuing these injunctions all passionately disagree with the thing that's being challenged in that. So that principle that, well, this we think is really unconstitutional, therefore we should ignore the general principles of Article III, is not a principle the court ought to adopt.
Justice Kagan?
So, General, on this question of expedition, I mean, it sort of depends on the government's own actions in a case like this one, where one can expect that there is not going to be a great deal of disagreement among the lower courts. I mean, let's assume that you lose in the lower courts pretty uniformly, as you have been losing on this issue, and that you never take this question to us. I mean, I noticed that you didn't take the substantive question to us. You only took the nationwide injunction question to us. I mean, why would you take the substantive question to us? You're losing a bunch of cases, this guy over here, this woman over here. You know, they'll have to be treated as citizens, but nobody else will. Why would you ever take this case to us?
Well, in this particular case, we have deliberately not presented the merits to this court on the question of the scope of remedies, because, of course, that makes it a clean vehicle where the court doesn't have to look at the past.
You're ignoring the import of my question. I'm suggesting that in a case in which the government is losing constantly, there's nobody else who's going to appeal, they're winning, it's up to you to decide whether to take this case to us. If I were in your shoes, there is no way I'd approach the Supreme Court with this case. So you just keep on losing in the lower courts. And what's supposed to happen to prevent that?
Again, I respectfully disagree with that forecast of the merits. But in response to the question, what I would say is we have an adversarial system. And if the government is not, for example, not respecting circuit precedent on the court's hypothetical in the Second Circuit, someone injured in the Second Circuit could take the case up. And they could say, look, the government is violating circuit precedent on the hypothetical multiple circuits.
That's the case we're going to take? Somebody who says, you know, after we've said that this all has to be done one by one by one, then we're going to take a case from somebody who objects to proceeding one by one by one?
I'm not sure I understand the question. I understand the hypothetical.
If you win this challenge and say there is no nationwide injunction and it all has to be through individual cases, then I can't see how an individual who was not, you know, being treated equivalently to the individual who brought the case would have any ability to bring the substantive question to us.
They would bring a lawsuit in the federal district courts against the government for an injunction protecting them. And if the government wasn't respecting, you know, on the hypothetical circuit
precedent. And then they win. And again, I mean, you need somebody to lose. But nobody's going to lose in this case. It's just you're going to have, like, individual by individual by individual, and all of those individuals are going to win, and the ones who can't afford to go to court, they're the ones who are going to lose.
The tools that are provided to address hypotheticals like this, again,
This is not a hypothetical. This is happening out there, right? Every court has ruled against you.
We've only had snap judgments on the merits. You know, obviously, we're fully briefing the merits in the courts of appeals, and our arguments are compelling. More fundamentally, in response to the question,
I'm suggesting to you, like, the real brunt of my question is, in a case like this, the government has no incentive to bring this case to the Supreme Court because it's not really losing anything. It's losing a lot of individual cases which still allow it to enforce its EO against the vast majority of people to whom it applies.
And again, Rule 23 provides an avenue to present to address those very concerns.
Thank you.
Justice Gorsuch?
Well, Justice Kagan asked my questions better than I could have. How do you suggest we reach this case on the merits expeditiously?
There's a number of tools the court can do that. We think this case is one that cries out for percolation, that the court should allow the lower courts to address the merits issue multiple times. It's currently on briefing in three different cases in the First, Fourth, and Ninth Circuits, and we think that that's the appropriate way to do it. If the court disagreed, obviously...
When you lose one of those, do you intend to seek cert?
If we lose, yes, absolutely.
Justice Kavanaugh?
So the technical problem here seems to be class-wide relief without the district courts going through the steps to assess whether a class should be certified, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And if you win here on this procedural point, it seems very likely that the day after, there are going to be suits filed all over the place seeking class-wide treatment, maybe statewide classes, circuit-wide classes, maybe nationwide classes. I'm sure they're being prepared now. Right? And on what basis would you oppose a statewide class?
I could imagine certain bases, and again, we haven't briefed this in the lower courts yet.
You've been promising everyone here that Rule 23 is the cure-all. And I want to explore on what basis you would oppose a statewide class. Just take that one for now.
For example, and again, this is very hypothetical because I'm not predicting that we will or will not oppose that. We haven't taken a position on that yet.
If you were to oppose it, on what basis would you plausibly oppose it?
There may be problems of commonality and typicality, for example. For example, there's two different sets of groups that are affected by the executive order. There are those where the mothers are temporarily present and those where the mother are illegally present. And in both cases, the father is neither a citizen nor a lawful permanent resident. So there might be issues of typicality. Adequacy of representation might very well be an issue. So there would have to be that rigorous application of those criteria. Now, the argument may be this is a case that is a natural candidate for a Rule 23b2 certification. That may well be true. The government hasn't taken a position on that. Our position is not that class certification will necessarily be granted. Our position is that Rule 23 is how these sorts of claims should be channeled.
And you think, I think you just said, it's very possible that class certification may be granted.
It is possible. We don't know yet because there was a class certification motion filed at the very beginning in Western District of Washington, and it was just never briefed because obviously the pathology here is that the nationwide injunctions just go blowing past the class certification procedures.
And I guess Rule 23b2, for a lot of the cases we've had over the past 25 years that you talk about where there have been universal injunctions or the lower courts have had that, I mean, 23b2 could have been used in a lot of those. Presumably, correct? Eviction moratorium, student loans, OSHA vaccine mandate. Do you see the possibility that 23b2 could have been used instead of, I mean, some of those were APA, but put aside the APA issue for now.
Yeah, we do set aside that issue, if yes. I may.
I got it.
But yes, I agree with that as to some, but not of the other cases. It's hard to see how, for example, Biden against Nebraska, where a state was the plaintiff, might have been a 23b2 class. And the Alabama Association of Realtors might have been a much better candidate for that. And again, not taking a position on the individual merits, our overarching point is there's a tradition of equity in this country that goes back to the English Court of Chancery and what's happening in these universal injunctions. Again, 40 times in this administration, at least 22 times in the last administration, 64 times in the administration before that, is just disregarding those appropriate procedures to seek this kind of global relief.
I want to ask one thing about something in your brief. You said, quote, and of course, this court's decisions constitute controlling precedent throughout the nation. If this court were to hold a challenge statute or policy unconstitutional, the government could not successfully enforce it against anyone, party or not, in light of stare decisis, end quote. You agree with that?
Yes, we do.
If you prevail here, the original executive order had a 30-day period before it took effect. If you prevail here, should there be any pause in so that things can happen that need to happen for 30 days or some period of time, or should we not even worry about that?
Yes, we can see that the 30-day ramp-up period that the executive order itself calls for never started because the universal TROs were entered almost immediately, and we don't dispute that there should be a 30-day ramp-up period. For another reason as well, which is that we've been enjoined from even doing guidance, even formulating a policy, and that itself is another problem with these injunctions.
On the day after it goes into effect, this is just a very practical question, how this is going to work. What do hospitals do with a newborn? What do states do with a newborn?
I don't think they do anything.